Who do you turn to when you are undergoing a double mastectomy but do not have any evidence of disease yet? What are the resources available to fit your situation? Have you ever heard of a previvor? You're not alone.
Welcome to WonderCast, a community collaborative podcast supporting families navigating the complexities of chronic illness or injury. WonderCast is supported by the generous sponsorship of Texas Oncology. Texas Oncology, more breakthroughs, more victories, experts in cancer care.
Today, we are joined by Rochelle Shuby, licensed oncology social worker with Atlanta Cancer Care. Tune in and learn all about what life can look like as a previvor, the resources available to you, and how to support those that find themselves in this unique role. Meet Rochelle.
I'm Rochelle. I've been a social worker for 12 years, 4 years working in oncology. I'm a dog mom to a little rescue named Chicken Nugget, who I love dearly. I've lived in Atlanta my whole life. My whole family is here. They live about 5 miles away from each other, and I'm about 20 minutes from them, and we're super close. And my experience with my family and cancer led me to my work.
That is the dream, to live 5 minutes away, 5 miles away from family. That's amazing. I had that once, and then I left it. I love that you've been able to have that still. And I love the name Chicken Nugget.
Thank you. So he's a rescue, and he was found as a stray running around the streets playing chicken with the cars. So his foster mom named him Chicken. And when I saw his picture, I said, look at this little nugget. And it was born.
I love it. Well, what I'll do is I might have you share a little bit about the work that you do.
Sure. So I work for a medical oncology practice. In my work, I support patients with their emotional needs and any kind of practical needs that come up. So things are like barriers to care. So transportation issues, housing issues, utilities, stuff like that. Every day is different. We do a lot of screenings. So like screenings for suicidal ideations, anxiety, depression, stuff like that. And sometimes people ask me, how do you do what you do? There's never a good answer to that. You definitely have to feel a calling or a passion to do this work. It's not easy, but it's meaningful, and I'm proud of what I do.
And I think the fact that every day looks different to me, that's empowering. You can't do compassionate care without diversity in your day, because I feel like you would just spiral into burnout, right? And we wouldn't be our best self.
And it's never boring. The work is interesting, and I feel like I learn so much. And I've learned so much from the patients I work with, right? Like, just about gratitude and moving through grief and what that looks like, and resiliency, and just some of these really core things that people go through. You know, I'm not going to work and just sitting in front of a computer all day. I'm helping people through what could be like the most difficult thing they've ever experienced in their life. And that doesn't surpass me. I lean into that when I'm having a hard day. I'm like, oh, well, you know, think about the person I sat with today and what kind of day they're having. And it puts things into perspective for sure.
Part of the reason you chose this profession was because of some of your experiences with cancer. If you're comfortable, I would love for you to share about what those are.
Absolutely. So I feel like cancer has been a part of my life, my entire life. I grew up with an aunt who had ovarian cancer in her 30s. A lot of my childhood memories surround being with her. I mean, I have pictures of my childhood where the background is clearly Northside Hospital. I remember times where she was inpatient and my family would commandeer the conference room to have family dinner so she could be included, sitting with her while she was having treatment. As an aside, I actually worked for the practice where she was a patient. So it's kind of like a full circle moment for me, for sure. And so it was just normal. Like, it wasn't like this weird experience for me. Like, that's just kind of how life was. And then she died. And it's like this thing that we had as a family, like our family experience just kind of ended. Like, not only her just being gone, but like we were family caretakers and that role just ended. And as a child, like trying to process that grief was weird and interesting. And this was back in the 90s when programs like you have just didn't exist. And so it was almost an experience where I felt like the grief was for the adult. Like, I didn't know what to do with my feelings. I didn't. Like, I had issues relating with my peers because, like, what do you mean you're not dealing with this? You don't miss Aunt Bev too? Like, what's going on? And so in my 10-year-old mind, it was, I don't have any friends. To my parents' credit, like, they were younger than me now when they were dealing with this and their grief, and they didn't have the guidebook. So we just did the best we could. And then my mom was diagnosed with breast cancer. You know, all those fears came back. Like, what does this mean? Is she going to die? And her doctor actually suggested that she go for genetic testing. She was in her early 40s, her sister being in her 30s with ovarian. And we found out that she was a BRCA1 carrier. And then her parents were tested. My grandfather was the carrier. My mom has another sister. She's also positive. So it just became like this bigger thing. Like, this really is a family experience. We are genetically linked to cancer. It's just kind of literally part of us. You know, I knew that I would eventually need to be tested. I didn't want to be tested until I was ready to do something about it. So once you know, you got to do. So I was the first one of my generation, and I was 23, and I tested positive and, like, immediately started surveillance. So by yearly mammograms and breast MRIs and pelvic ultrasounds and all those fun things that, again, none of my peers were dealing with. So I couldn't talk to my friends about what it felt like to have a mammogram in my early 20s. Like, that just wasn't an experience that they ever had. It was a bit isolating. When I was trying to figure out career, when I decided I wanted to be a social worker, it was just like, you're going to work with people who are dealing with this. Like, this is just what you're going to do. Like, it means something. Like, I wanted to be the person that I felt like we needed, like, for guidance and to know more, like, feel some sort of empowerment where, like, I felt so powerless. And so I went to graduate school, and when I finished, I got connected with a organization called Bright Pink that supports young women who are high risk for breast and ovarian cancer. And I started the support group here in Atlanta. And like a month later, my sister, who also had tested positive, felt a lump and was diagnosed with breast cancer at 23.
23. God, that's so hard.
Yeah, that was a whirlwind for sure.
Your genetic history played a significant impact in your healthcare journey.
You know, having your genetic knowledge and your family history knowledge, going to a genetic counselor, connecting to a high-risk clinic, but knowing my risk, knowing my family history, knowing people so close to me who've experienced that, that definitely led to me making choices to reduce my risk. After my sister was diagnosed, a couple months into her treatment, I had my bi-yearly MRI, and they found an abnormality. And my doctor had a very frank discussion with me. They were like, we could do a surgical biopsy and find out what this is, or we could proceed with a risk-reducing mastectomy. You know, that's a choice that you would have probably made at some point in your life anyway. And it's not an easy choice to make. It was not an easy experience at all. I was in my late 20s. Bodies are weird and interesting, and we, as women, kind of have a love-hate relationship with our bodies throughout our lives. And so to feel like I'm losing this part of myself as a quote-unquote choice was very difficult, but I made it. I mean, I sat there with my sister throughout all of her treatment, and like, I just felt like, how could I wait for that to happen to me when I have this opportunity now to severely reduce my risk? So I proceeded and had a double mastectomy and had reconstruction, and it was a journey. It was not easy. Like I said, there were infections and there was, you know, several surgeries that were involved. But here I am 10 years later, and I couldn't be more grateful. And I love myself again. I know we had discussed when we met nipple tattoos, which is the last piece for me. I haven't quite done that yet, but you have inspired me to move forward with that. And I'm excited. And then, you know, you also have to think about how it affects your reproductive health. And I don't have kids. And it's the question of, like, is that something that I want for myself? Do I not want for myself? So I did do an egg retrieval, which again is a privilege. I mean, that, you know, it's expensive for everybody, but not having a cancer diagnosis, I was not eligible for any kind of assistance. So that was something that I had to prepare for. And then in April, I had my fallopian tubes removed to reduce my ovarian cancer risk. Those were the decisions that I made for myself.
Now, 10 years later, do you have regrets, or do you feel like that was definitely the right decision to make?
I definitely feel like it was the right decision to make. I do wish that, you know, maybe things, I wish I was a little more mature. I had a lot of people around me with a lot of anxiety. My sister had just gone through treatment and she ended up having a recurrence and it was like their worst nightmare. And she's great now. She's about to have her second baby and I couldn't be more excited for her. But I felt a lot of pressure, like to not be the next one that they're waiting for to be diagnosed. So I wish I was a little bit the person I am now then, so I could have, you know, shared my truth a little bit more, my feelings. I had some people around me say some very negative things. I remember one time I got very emotional at my doctor's office and the response was not the best. My doctor said to me, "Don't you counsel people in this?" And I thought, well, I'm a human being too. I can have feelings. But yeah, even some friends or my partner at the time just quite didn't understand this choice, which, listen, when you don't come from a family like this, like it seems like a very extreme choice. I get it. But having people ask questions like, are you doing this because Angelina Jolie did it? Like, what else are you going to cut off? You know, it was not the added pressure I needed at the time when I myself was trying to figure out my feelings. But again, like it grew into a different level of understanding. I feel like I have a different level of empathy because of the experiences that I've had.
The concept of previvorship, which is what this episode is about.
Yeah.
Is something that I feel like you just didn't hear about until recently. It was even in the Women's Cancer and Care Act. It used to be that previvor surgeries were not covered under that act. All of the advocacy that went in to getting that written into the bill. Thank you to all of those lawmakers, policyholders, physicians that weighed in, because yes, it is a choice that you made, but you're not choosing, hey, I want to do this just for cosmetics reasons. You're choosing, do I want cancer or do I not want cancer of this sort? Sure, it's not 100% foolproof, right? There could be other cancers that still happen, but you are on a freight train heading to the station of Cancer Town, and you had an opportunity to get off that train. Nobody chooses that for just joyfulness of what they want to do. As somebody who has gone through that surgery as well with reconstruction and everything it entails, it's not fun.
Not fun. A free boob job. For anyone who's ever said that, please stop.
Like, please stop. Go do some research. You are left with both physical and emotional scars. Not a boob job. While my plastic surgeon is a genius, Dr. Potter, shout out to you, genius. While she is incredible, this is still not the body that I've known and cherished and taken care of my whole life. It is now different. I have nerve loss, scars. I have positioning changes. And I'm sure you do as well. Your body is not the same as what it was. But the beauty is you now hopefully get for the rest of your life and it actually be a long and lengthy life. Whereas before, you were looking at a very difficult battle.
Yeah, absolutely. And you brought up the insurance piece. I mean, that was a struggle as well, because this was around this time, it was when ACA was kind of being first implemented and I was in a grandfathered plan. And I remember specifically having a conversation when I was up for renewal, would this be covered? And they told me yes. And I had picked a date. I had gotten myself prepared, bought all the things, did all the research, literally was in the middle of training my replacement for when I was out, got a call from my insurance company, we're not covering this. And my brain exploded. Like, what do you mean you're not covering this? So luckily, I was a social worker. And so I went into social work go mode and I called all my doctors and got letters of medical necessity. I printed out articles. I went down to the insurance commissioner's office and started an investigation. And they said, give us a month. And a month later, I got a call, your surgery is being covered. It went from being scared to do this, having to fight for the thing I was scared of, and then having to readjust my mind like, okay, this is happening again. On top of just the whole grief process of I'm having my breasts removed, like it was a lot and so unnecessary.
So unnecessary. And you know, here is something that I think is pretty wonderful. All of the resistance that any previvor I've ever met has received has never been from somebody that has faced cancer.
Yes.
It has been from the community members, from the insurance companies, from the people that don't know. And then the people that do know, the people who have that lived experience, they don't want that for anybody.
They do not want that for us. They don't, because they're thinking, I wish I had that opportunity to know that this was going to happen to me and could have done something about it. It does make the concept of pre-survivorship strange, though. Like, it's definitely like this limbo space. Like, I'm not a survivor. I've never been told you have cancer, but I have a lot of the same lived experience, like anxiety of something, scanxiety. Like, I very much understand my patients talk about the concept of scanxiety. Like, is this the time they're going to find something? I know what that feels like. When my patients talk about the fears of upcoming surgeries or what to expect, or, you know, how to deal with family taking care of you afterwards, like the vulnerability of allowing someone to help you. I understand all of this, but I'm not in their shoes. Like, I'm not in that space, but I'm also not like just a normal everyday person living their best life, not having to think about these things. So it's very much like this middle ground. I'm so glad that there is a provider community available that, you know, we can all come together and understand what this feels like and support each other, because we need that. We need that community for sure.
What do you wish people could have said to you when you explained what you were doing and why?
Oh, that's such a good question. I think listening is just so important. I really didn't need anyone's opinions or anyone's judgment or anyone's thoughts. Like, please keep those to yourself. I'm an advocate. I'm an educator. Those are the things that I love. So, like, for me personally, not everyone feels this way. I'm open to questions. I love discussions. I love opportunities to teach people and to let people know that this is a thing. Like, know family history, ask questions. There are so many family secrets. I mean, how many people I've spoke to, like, I think my grandma had stomach cancer. Like, no, grandma had ovarian cancer. Like, you just need to like ask and find out what's going on. Go to your doctors and talk about these things. And that's the space where I find empowerment, where I find that this has been helpful for me. I feel like after my sister was diagnosed, I was enraged. Like, she was 23, so she wasn't even starting surveillance yet, because this, you know, the medical standard is to start at 25. And it's only because she knew she was BRCA positive that they took this seriously and sent her for a biopsy. How many young women I know who don't have that opportunity, and next thing we know, we're treating young 20-year-old with advanced breast cancer. After she was diagnosed, I went on a rampage of like, I will talk to anyone and everybody. I mean, I was kind of already on this journey to be in this field. At the time I was working in hospice, I hadn't made my way into the oncology world yet, which I'm a little grateful for. I don't know how well I would have done working in oncology, having to support her through this. It would have been very triggering for me.
Asking questions is 100% welcomed.
Yeah.
But your questions should not be questioning the decisions to debate it. Question it, sure, to understand, to gain the information, not to challenge the information.
100%. Yeah. Like, don't question people's decisions. And also, like, you know, I'd like to give people the benefit of the doubt. Don't be inappropriate. Like, you don't have to ask me questions about my body. Like, if I want to give information that's of my own free will. I mean, there were times when my bright pink group, we would meet and there were women who just had profound family histories. There were people with genetic mutations. There were people who were considering surgeries, who were post-surgeries, and some women who ended up being diagnosed with cancer. And I remember, like, those of us who had had surgeries would end up in the bathroom with those of us who didn't have surgery, lifting our shirts, showing scars, like giving all the information, because we just wanted to support the next one. I mean, I severely appreciated when a friend of my mom's, and she had her risk-reducing mastectomy, and she had the latissimus flap reconstruction, which is what I had. And she was so open to showing me what that looked like. And I appreciated that, because I had an idea of what to expect.
I mean, we can share the very first time you and I met face-to-face. I took you in a room and took off my shirt.
You sure did. And I appreciated that so much, because although I've seen pictures, like, to see it in real life, like what a tattoo looked like, it was like, I can do that. You know, like, I've been so scared. Like, I've gotten to this point, and I didn't want to put something on my body that would make me revert back to the times where I was really struggling with what my reconstruction looked like. And so I was listening to your podcast and hearing you guys talk about pepperoni nipples and thinking like, that is my worst nightmare. Like, I'd rather not have. Like, I'm fine. I've been fine this whole time. But like, for you to give me the opportunity to see what it could look like, I appreciate that severely.
I will say again, just another layer of all of this is the censorship that happens with women's bodies in general from education standpoint. Sure, there's pornography. There is lewd and inappropriate things out there. Breast reconstruction is not that.
It is not that. And this is educational. Why are we sexualizing cancer and the breast? There's nothing I hate more than when they're like, save the tatas, like save the women, person.
Agreed.
Who are attached to the breasts that are experiencing this issue. Like, let's not put the focus on the breasts and like sexualize this situation. I mean, it's even the same when people were asking me about my decisions around my ovaries. Well, are you just not going to have kids? Are you just not going to do this? It's like, well, I just want to not have ovarian cancer like my aunt. I don't want to have the experience that she had. So I did an egg retrieval. So I have that opportunity should I want it. I did my research. I met with my doctors. And so the decision to remove my fallopian tubes, because I am in my 30s, I'm premenopausal. I didn't want to go into surgical menopause. And so to know that they're doing this national study that a lot of ovarian cancers start in the fallopian tubes, and removing that reduces my risk without introducing the very real issues of surgical menopause or my body is ready for that. That was worth the risk for me. And so I did that. And I know that I can make another decision in a couple of years and check out the rest if I need to, but I'm comfortable where I am. And that was also question two. Why aren't you removing everything? Well, because I'm not ready for that. And I'd rather do something than nothing. People don't understand like the bigger impact of women's health and having choice, and people can feel what they want. But when you take away access to women's health, it reverberates and it's bigger. And I don't think people realize the bigger impact unless it impacts them or someone they know.
There are so many stigmas, especially when it comes to cancer care, any cancer care involving reproductive organs.
Yeah.
You run into a lot of unwanted opinions. My hope is that through conversations with survivors and previvors, with advocacy, with education, that people come to realize that this is a multifaceted decision, and it's a decision that deserves options. Because there have been those options, you have the opportunity to have children down the road. You have the opportunity to pace out your reconstructive care. You had reconstruction 10 years ago, and you are still in this recovery phase of looking at nipple tattooing, which is included in the Women's Cancer Care Act. It matters. It matters that there is that accessibility. And so when you hear about these plastic surgeons like Dr. Elizabeth Potter that are up on Capitol Hill pushing agendas, they're not pushing it so that they can just have more work,
right,
and make more money. They are pushing it so that they can advocate for the decisions that women deserve to make.
Yeah, I love that you said that, because I feel like sometimes people get caught up in what they think doctors' agendas are. And especially oncologists, they just care so much for their patients. I've been in this field for 4 years. I have not met, and obviously been in the cancer community again my whole life. I don't know any oncologist that's in this for the money. They care for their patients. They just want people to get better, and that's not always the outcome. And so when they are fighting for rights and access, like, that's just so real. And I would love to spend my, you know, the rest of my career being part of that fight, because I know how that affects people on so many layers and levels.
Do you feel that being a previvor is still something that is somewhat taboo, or do you feel like it is becoming more mainstream conversation?
I don't think we're all the way there yet. I bring up this term to people and they've never heard of it before, even within the community, but we're getting there. Like, I feel the change even from when I entered into this realm. I feel like access to support has just increased. These conversations have increased, you know, different hospitals having high-risk clinics. I think that's just so important to have very specialized care and having providers who are aware of this type of care and having genetic counseling and having surveillance and having opportunities to have risk-reducing surgeries, I think is just going to be more understood. And like, why should we not have access to this? I would love to see the community grow. I would love to see accessibility to assistance grow, to know that I wasn't able to access some of the resources that are available. And listen, like part of it was my feelings like, oh, maybe I'm not as deserving because I don't have cancer and I'm not sitting in that chemo chair. But no, you know, I was also going through this really difficult thing and having some access to some resources for assistance would have been really helpful and maybe wouldn't have kind of kept me in, you know, this closet of my feelings because I didn't feel like I was as deserving.
As you know, Wonders and Worries is now able to provide direct in-person care to our greater Metro Atlanta. And that is just such an incredible milestone that we are so excited to share. We do support families facing serious illness or injury that does include pre-vivorship as well. And I feel like that is an important thing for us to note. So if you have someone in your family that is undergoing a double mastectomy or preventative care for prostate cancer, ovarian, something along those lines that is preventative, and you are facing a surgery, there are support systems in place to help your children understand what's happening.
I love that so much. So I think it's a continued conversation, and I think that I'm looking forward to seeing what it becomes.
For anybody that maybe carries a difficult genetic history and has been listed as somebody who falls in this pre-vivor category, what advice do you have for them as they are considering their options?
I definitely feel like they need to be connected to other people. Like, don't sit in this alone with your feelings. Connecting with the right medical team. I have found a lot of support in an organization called FORCE, Facing Our Risk of Cancer Empowered. They have different support groups. If you are privileged enough to live close to a hospital system that has a high-risk clinic, see what kind of support that they offer. Cancer Support Community offers a lot of support as well. So connecting with your state's cancer support community, calling the national helpline and asking them what resources are available would be really helpful. And having open conversations with your family, if you have that kind of dynamic that lends to that. Educating your friends and having them come aboard and like telling them how they can support you. Like, it's not rude to tell people what you need from them. I think we make assumptions that they just know and they don't.
Thank you for tuning into our podcast today. Please subscribe and continue to check back as our content is ever evolving. For questions or specific content-related requests, please send an email to podcast@wondersandworries.org.